Welcome, brethren, to this weekly Sabbath we so eagerly wait for each week. Brethren, throughout the Bible are many examples of people praying and crying out to God in sorrow or thanksgiving, asking for guidance and help. David, in many of the Psalms, is crying out in distress. One such example is found in Psalms 51, where King David is petitioning God for his very survival in God's family. He asks for his sins to be remembered no more. And in verse 11, he says, "Don't throw me away from your presence. Don't take your Holy Spirit from me." God heard and answered David's prayers. Hannah, in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 11, petitioned God for a son and promised him to Yahweh's service all the days of his life. In verse 17, Eli answered, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him." Hannah's son was born and named Samuel, which means ask of God or God answered. Jonah cried out from the belly of the great fish, and God heard his cries. Jonah chapter 2, verse 2, he said, "I called because of my affliction to Yahweh. He heard me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried. You did hear my voice." Jonah was rejoicing in the fact that God had heard his prayers. Moses, in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 25, fell down before the Eternal, praying and fasting 40 days and 40 nights. He cried out for Aaron and all the children of Israel that God should not destroy them. God heard and answered Moses' prayers. God knows our needs and desires long before we ask concerning them. He wants us to ask anyway. He wants us to develop a relationship with Him. He knows what will help us, what will hurt us, and what will make us grow as He is creating Elohim. There are things to ask God and things you should not ask God. Also, there are ways to ask God and ways not to ask God. God wants us to know who He is, who we are, and that we need to ask of Him. That is what we want to discuss today. So the title, for those who would like one, is Ask God. The first point we want to look at today is why ask God. Why do we ask God for anything? Psalms chapter 91, verse 1. Firstly, we ask God because we believe and or have faith that He is the Almighty Yahweh Elohim, or the Eternal, and that He can hear us, and that He has the power to answer all of our prayers and petitions. We believe also that He is the highest authority and superior over all His creation, and has the power over all things. Psalms chapter 91, verse 1. "He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty." David knew who he was talking about. In verse 2, "I will say of Yahweh, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust." When we ask God for that which we need and desire, we are acknowledging to God and to ourselves who we are in relation to God. I know as a whole you all know this, but I felt compelled to add it in anyways. We only pray to God the Father, the Eternal, or Yahweh, the self-existing one. We don't pray to Mary. We don't pray to Jesus Christ hanging on a cross. But as commanded, we do pray to the Father in Jesus Christ's name. The next point we want to look at today is how to ask God. How to ask God, 1 Peter chapter 5. We heard, or have heard in many sermons and many times, that we can pray standing, sitting, lying down, just don't fall asleep, thinking out loud, or with just your lips mouthing the words as Hannah was doing. Windshield time seems to be a big one these days. I know I spend a lot of time driving back and forth, and I get a lot of windshield time. And it's not too bad now that they have Bluetooth, because people don't look at you like you're funny anymore like they used to. It can be a long and planned out or just a quick blurb in times of need. But today we want to look at some of the attitudes in relation to how we petition God or ask of God. The first, of course, is humbly. 1 Peter 5, verse 6. Humble yourselves. Now, this does not mean to be weak or mealy or cowardly. Sometimes you even go for that God that way because of sin, usually, your guilt. Moses was by no means a weak man, but he was a meek man and a very humble man. It says, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. Cast all of your worries on him, because he cares for you. So we want to go humbly before God with our petitions. Unselfishly is another one. Turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 8. Let me interject this here. There are a couple of scriptures we're going to look at here in a moment, but it needs to be said. God did not and does not promise to give you every whim and desire that we can come up with if we only ask. There are restrictions placed upon it that we will mention in a moment. 2 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 8. Solomon said to God, and in the previous verses God had told Solomon, ask what I shall give you. Solomon said to God, you have showed great loving kindness to David my father, and have made me king in his place. Verse 10. Give me now wisdom and knowledge, that I may go out and come in before this people. For who can judge your people that is so great? Verse 11, God said back to Solomon, because this was in your heart. How did he get there? God put it there. He knew what was in Solomon's heart when he asked that first question, what shall I give you? Because this was in your heart, you have not asked for riches or wealth or honor, nor the life of those that hate you, neither yet have you asked long life, but have asked wisdom and knowledge for yourself, that you may judge my people, whom I have made you king. In other words, you did not ask for things to spend on your own selfish lusts. Verse 12, wisdom and knowledge is granted to you, and I will give you riches and wealth and honor, such as none of the kings have had who have been before you, neither shall there any after you have the like. So we want to ask God unselfishly. And in asking God, there's a good possibility that if you need to be praying for something or for things, it may be lacking in others as well. Don't turn there, but James chapter 5, verse 16 reminds us to pray for one another, that you may be healed. We are instructed by Paul in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 25, brothers, pray for us. He's talking about the leadership of the church, that they can be kept in the truth and the light. That was also addressed in God's posting concerning ordinations. Paul also tells us to pray for all people and the leadership in the world. You can jot this down and I'll quickly read it. 1 Timothy 2, verse 1. 1 Timothy 2, verse 1. I exhort, therefore, first of all, that petitions, prayers, intercessions, and givings of thanks be made for all men. Verse 2. For kings and all who are in high places, that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and reverence. It is a display of unselfishness and love when we are petitioning God for others or on the behalf of others. The next one is asking boldly. Turn to 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3. We should have a boldness to go before God and know that he will hear us and answer our prayers because we have a continual relationship with him. If this relationship is weak because of sin or neglect, this boldness will be missing in our prayers. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 21. Beloved, if our hearts don't condemn us, how is it that our hearts condemn us? Unrepented sin, guilt, doubt, neglect. Beloved, if our hearts don't condemn us, we have a boldness. If we know we are repenting every day of our lives, if there are things happening in our lives and we're going before God because we recognize that sin that cuts us off from God, sin has to be repented of. It may be what we consider small things, simple things that in the course of life we might not even think about it as sin, but it's there. And we have to repent of these things before God, of all these things. And then we can have a confidence and boldness in our petitions to God. Once again, if our hearts don't condemn us, we have boldness towards God. Verse 22, and whatever we ask, we receive from Him. Now, that is a very strong statement that is often misunderstood in the Church of God because it has to do with the matter of God's will. If you know there are certain things in your mind that are a matter of God's will, things that you know are His will, you can ask God about these things and you know that they are going to be done. You have that confidence. You just know it. There are other things sometimes in our lives that we ask, that we have petition and desire for, that may or may not be a part of God's plan and purpose. And it's not wrong to desire these things, but we're not guaranteed to get them based on the statements above. We can certainly ask God to take a look at it, to consider it, certain aspects of our lives that we may want God to intervene or to help us in. He may or may not intervene, His choice. But He knows what is best for us. He knows what is best for our spiritual and physical growth. But about other things that are a part of God's plan and God's purpose and what He is doing in your life and in the lives of others and creating Elohim, we can pray with a greater boldness in these things, brethren, and know that they're going to be done. Verse 22 again. And whatever we ask, we receive from Him because we keep His commandments. We are obedient to Him. We want and desire to obey Him. And do the things that are pleasing in His sight. A desire to be pleasing to God. A desire to honor God by how we live our lives towards others. A desire to be a better example to those around us in the world, in the church, and in our families. 1 John chapter 5, verse 14. 1 John chapter 5, verse 14. Let's just forward a few pages. This is the boldness, that confidence, which we have toward Him, that if we ask anything according to His will, He listens to us. Another way of saying this in the English language would be, when you ask for something, do so according to God's will. In verse 15, and if we know that He listens to us, whatever we ask, we know that we have the petitions which we have asked of Him. These scriptures are not saying that you will get everything you ask for. By all means, in the other direction. Certainly you can ask for things, and we will be covering some of those in a moment. But sometimes the answer may just be a simple no. Something that needs to be interjected here at this time. You know, brethren, without this confidence we spoke of earlier, we will fail to do our part in fulfilling these petitions to God. We may go to Him and mention them to Him, but without that boldness, we won't act upon them. And many of the things that we ask for from God also require action on our part. If you ask for a job or intervention in your financial situation and only spend 10 minutes looking for a job or 5 minutes bettering yourself to be a better employee or a better businessman, there's a good chance that you're not going to find that help. God wants to intervene for us, but are you seriously doing your part? Are you beating the streets for work if you have asked for the means to support yourself? I mean, that's just a thought. There are a couple of other scriptures, John 14:13, and I think John 16:26. You can read them later. But they certainly fall under these same guidelines when petitioning God, according to God's will and His plan and purpose in creating Elohim. All other petitions, you may get a yes or you may get a no. there are a lot more attitudes that we should consider when petitioning God, and I didn't have these listed in my notes, so I'll just mention them. I mean, it's by no means a full list, and you can come up with some on your own, but like thankfully petitioning God and petitioning God often are just a couple of other attitudes that pop into my mind that I didn't have mentioned in my notes. Let's continue on. Matthew chapter 6. We have addressed a couple of ways to ask God, and there are certainly some examples also in the Bible of how to not ask God, and we will look at some of them now. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 7. In praying, don't use vain repetitions. Now, I often feel like a broken record when I open my prayers. I did it again, Father. Please forgive me. Forgive me again. Forgive me again. And again. But that's not what's being referred to here. What's being referred to here is chantings, scripted or written prayers, formulaic in nature. And not to pick on any one pagan group or over another, but things like the Rosary and Hail Mary and the Lord's Prayer, just to mention a few. If you don't know what these are, you're that much ahead. Again, I wouldn't suggest going and reading them or looking them up. Again, in prayer, don't use vain repetitions as the Gentiles do, for they think that they will be heard for their much speaking. Prayer wheels or pen wheels would be another form of this. A disc or cylinder, or I don't know how to describe a pen wheel, but except to say a pen wheel, would have the chantings written on the outside, and people would come up and spin them or blow on them many times, and they actually believe that spinning these wheels will have much the same meritorious effect as orally reciting the prayers. And, you know, they're right. Spinning those wheels has just as much meritorious effect as orally chanting or reciting those prayers. As well, we in the church, we can fall into a rut with our prayers. You know, the one Mr. Harold speaks of that's situated on either side of the smooth highway. Our prayer life can fall into that same rut, and we can find ourselves repeating the same prayer over and over again and again. And this is not what God wants either. Brethren, He wants us to be excited. If we go before God humbly, boldly, unselfishly, and thankfully, you will have an excitement about you like you do when you meet up with your friends that you haven't seen for a really, really long time, and you're really excited to see them. And we need to go to God in that manner. He wants us to come to Him in that manner, not humdrum and repetitive and beat down. And, you know, you don't want God to see you coming and say, "Oh no, there comes David again, saying the same old things again. Quick, lock the prayer doors." Continue on. Verse 8. Therefore, don't be like them, for your Father knows what things you need before you ask Him. You know, discuss the situation with God. Ask Him to intervene or provide for your needs and desires, and go on about acting on them. Move on. One guideline of maybe how many times you ask God for something would be an example of Apostle Paul. Let's turn there and read it. 2 Corinthians 12. 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 7. By reason of the exceeding greatness of the revelations, that I should not be exalted excessively, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, that I should not be exalted excessively. Concerning this thing, I begged the Lord three times that it might depart from me. And this is where we get, you know, you ask for anointing three times and, well, and you go from there. He said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." And Paul continues on here. "Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my weakness, that the power of Christ may rest on me." So ask a couple, three times and go on. James chapter 4. Here's another example that ties in earlier where we were talking about Solomon's prayers, where he was asking for wisdom to give and to serve others. Verse 2. James chapter 4, verse 2. "You lust and you have not. You kill, covet, and can't obtain. You fight and make war, yet you don't have because you don't ask." When you're not asking, you're trying to do it on your own. And God is not there. He's not in it. Verse 3. "You ask and don't receive And why don't you receive it when you ask? Because you ask amiss. You ask for your own selfish desires. And we humans we're a selfish bunch. Once again, verse 3. You ask and don't receive because you ask amiss, so that you may spend it on your own selfish pleasures. Once again, tying it all together, that just because you ask God for it does not mean you are actually going to get everything you ask for. But he wants you to ask anyways. Let's turn to Psalms chapter 40. Next, we want to go into some of the things that we should be asking God for, remembering that it is usually more important how and why we ask for something than the thing we are asking for itself. The first one to be addressed, which has been mentioned many, many times in recent sermons, and it's really important, so I want to mention it again, is ask God to keep you in the truth. Ask God to keep you in His truth. You do not want to be in this world without God's truth. The psalmist had a very beautiful way of expressing his desires to God. And as a note, it has been suggested you read these psalms if you find yourself short of words in your prayers. Just open up your Bible. You can be on your knees or just sitting down and just pick one and read it. You can even use it as a prayer. Psalms 40, verse 11. Don't withhold your tender mercies from me, Yahweh. Let your loving kindness and your truth continually preserve me. The writer here knew the importance of having God's truth continually and unbroken dwelling in his mind. Mr. Harrell has mentioned many times that once people begin to be cut off from God's Spirit, that the truth quickly dissipates from them exponentially. I think the term he uses is so fast it will make your head spin off. I think it's it. It is like somebody flips a light switch, the electricity stops flowing. The room goes dark immediately. There's no slow dimming effect. It's just gone. Turn ahead a few pages to Psalms 43. You know, and that's the way it is. Just like that electricity, that's the way it is with God's Spirit and God's truth. Same thing. Once you flip that light switch off, it's gone. Psalms 43, verse 3. Chapter 43, verse 3. Oh, send out your light and your truth. Let them lead me. Let them bring me to your holy hill, to your tents. Brethren, how do we know we are in God's church? Seriously, how is it that we know that this is the true church of God? It is because we have the truths of God. It is the truths of God that show us where we are and who we are. We have them dwelling in us, and we have them in the body as a whole. So ask God to keep you in His truth. Only God can turn that light switch back on if it is turned off, but it takes a lot. And frankly, we're not seeing it happen at this time. And I'm speaking of those that have been in PKG and had the truth and turned the light switch off. Only God has the power to turn it back on. There's two other scriptures I found, I took a break and I found two more scriptures I wanted to add here that were not in my notes, but I want to read them because they're pretty important here. Psalms 91 verse 4. You can turn it in. Psalms 91 verses 4. So you're already in Psalms, so it shouldn't be that hard. There's a theme here, but I just want to read this one verse in verse 4. He will cover you with feathers. Under his wings you will take refuge. His truth is a shield and a buckler. And another one, I'll just read this one quickly. Ephesians 6:14. Stand therefore, having the utility belt of truth buckled around your waist. Brethren, this truth that we have, these 57 truths that we have, will protect you. The next one I want to cover here is ask God for growth. Matthew 25. Turn to Matthew 25. Ask God for growth to develop a working relationship with God's Spirit dwelling in you. When you ask God for growth, what you are asking for in some cases, or should I say many cases, is trials. Growth comes through exercising God's Spirit through prayer, study, and fellowship with God's people, but it also comes through trials. Well, a trial comes along and we rush to God and say, please God, take this away. Remove this trial. Get rid of this. I don't want it. Heal me. But God uses these trials to point out our problems in our mind, in our thinking, that otherwise would never surface. Trials are like a symptom, sort of like pain. Pain is an indicator in the body that something is wrong. It's weakness leaving the body. Pain is an indicator in the body that something is wrong. And we always want the pain to go away even when we have not fixed the problem or the cause of the pain. Trials point to our weaknesses and show us the points where we need to grow or the things that we need to fix. If you are not growing, you are dying. There is no in-between. And this is true in both the physical as well as the spiritual realm. Just like muscles, those of us getting older know this, and I'm just beginning to experience some of this, by the way. If you're not working those muscles, or if you're not using those muscles, they are dying. Use it or lose it is the word on the street. And that's the same with God's Spirit. God's Spirit demands growth. There is no idleness. There is no neutral. God's Spirit demands growth. Matthew 25. God has given each of us a portion of His Spirit according to our abilities. Verse 15. To one He gave 5 talents, to one He gave another 2 talents, to one He gave 1 talent, to each according to his own ability, and he went on his journey. Immediately, he who had received the 5 talents went and traded with him and made another 5 talents. In like manner, he also who got the 2 talents gained another 2. They exercised the Spirit of God, and it grew in them and multiplied like it would on fertile ground. Verse 18. But he who received the 1 went away and dug in the earth and hid the Lord's money. Verse 19. Now after a long time, the Lord of those same servants came and reconciled accounts with them. He who received the 5 talents came and brought another 5 talents, saying, Lord, you delivered to me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained another 5 talents beside them. His Lord said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. Is this not the very words we want to hear from a loving, all-powerful, all-caring God? Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will set you over many things. Enter into the joy of the Lord. Drop on down to verse 24. Same thing happened with the guy with 2 talents. Verse 24. He also who had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew you were a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not scatter. I was afraid. I was afraid of what the world would think of me if I kept the Sabbath or if I keep these holy days. I was afraid that people might look at me weird, or I was afraid to believe that Jesus Christ was created, or I was afraid to belong to a church whose human leader, whose apostle, was in prison. I was afraid. I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the earth. Behold, you have your own. Drop down to verse 27. You ought therefore to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received back my own with interest. Take away therefore the talent from him, and give to him who has the 10 talents. Verse 29. For to everyone who has will be given, and he will have abundance. But from him who has not, even that which he has will be taken away. And here in verse 30, throw out the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. Remember that light switch we were talking about early, the outer darkness, how the room goes dark when you stop the flow of God's Spirit? God's Spirit demands growth. God demands growth. The last one to be covered is ask God to provide. And in this one, I'm going to lump multiple subtopics into it. This is not by no means a full extensive list, but more of some things that have come up in personal conversations over the past several years. And, you know, hopefully things in it will spur you to come up with your own ideas to ask God to provide for. Ask God to provide means to, or to provide the blessing to be able to travel to God's weekly Sabbath services. And if we were to grind that one down a little finer, to pound them down fine, we know that this includes finances to get there, safe travel, your health would be involved, protection from flu bugs and other sicknesses that you could spread during services. And this is a biggie here, a desire to be there. We know that these are prearranged appointments with God, and we don't want to miss out on them. One person no longer here told me some years back that they did not feel the desire to be there in Sabbath services, but they could just stay home and get everything they needed, you know, by listening at home. So ask God for that desire to be in Sabbath services. And by the way, they've been gone for a while, and their light switch was turned off and the room went dark. Another one would be to ask God to provide a holy day offering, Deuteronomy 16, verses 16. And just so that there is no doubting in your mind, this would totally be within God's will for you to ask for. I mean, it's a commandment. You're commanded to, well, let's just read there. We're reminded of this every holy day, so let's just read it. Deuteronomy 16, verse 16. 3 times a year shall all your males appear before Yahweh your God in the place where he shall choose. And they shall not appear before Yahweh empty. Verse 17. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of Yahweh your God, which he has given you. God has given you everything you have. And you know, the human mind can come up with a lot of excuses why not to give a holy day offering to God. But the answer back to these excuses is always, did you ask God to provide one for you if you don't have one? You know, even if it's only a penny, if that is all you have for an offering, a penny, and that's all it takes to be obedient to God in this manner. Along with this one, also, you know, I want to mention that as you begin to obey with him in this manner, ask him to provide tithes as well. When you come into the church, you know, your finances are probably stretched tight, or even if you've been in a while and you've suffered as of late, a reduction in employment or a reduction in hours, your hours are cut back. Ask God to provide you the means and the wherewithal to pay your tithes and to be able to pay your bills. And maybe he shows you better ways to handle that which you have rather than just simply giving you more. And other times he may indeed give you more. But ask God to provide these things. James chapter 1. Ask God to provide wisdom. Now, Mr. Matthews covered this one very extensively in 2 sermons titled Living Wisdom. Turn to James chapter 1, verse 5. Here we go, verse 5. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given him liberally. You know, he'll give you more than you ask for. But let him ask in faith, with confidence, confidence in knowing that you're going to get it, without doubting. For he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, driven by the wind and tossed. For let that man not think that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man and unstable in all his ways. And to add to that, when you ask for wisdom, and this applies to most things that we have discussed as well, when you ask God for wisdom, you need to participate. You need to do your part. After asking for this wisdom, and we need to ask. You can't just go there and read. You need to ask, and God will give it to you. But through those studies, and as we strive to live it and doing our part, we will gain that wisdom. And Proverbs is a good place to start. And speaking of Proverbs, let's turn to Proverbs chapter 3. The last one I want to mention today here is to ask God to provide favor. Ask God to give you favor. Ask God to bless the work of your hands that you may find favor in the sight of God and man. Ask for favor in all aspects of your life. If you find favor in small points in life, he usually prevents them from becoming really big points or big bad problems. There are many accounts in the Bible that speak of finding favor or being favored or given favor. Joseph was given favor in the prison system of that time and given charge over the other prisoners. Moses was given favor concerning the Egyptians, at first to prosper among them and later to destroy them. bears mentioning Esther, Nehemiah, Ruth, David, and so many others all found favor from God in his eyes as well as the eyes of man. And we are no different. We need God's favor. We are still ever so close to going into some awesome yet horrific times. They are just ahead of us, just before the finish line, and we are going to need God's favor. Proverbs 3, verses 4. Well, let's read it from verse 1, since it covers more on how to obtain favor. Verse 1, "My son, don't forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments." Verse 2, "For length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you." Verse 3, "Don't let kindness and truth forsake you." Here it is telling us what to do with the truth and how to not lose it, how to keep your light switch turned on. "Don't let kindness and truth forsake you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablets of your heart. So you will find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man." Once again, we are going to need God's favor if we are going to survive the coming events just ahead of us. We also need God's favor to survive the waiting period. Well, it's not really a waiting period, but a period of continual preparation before these events occur. So don't think of it as a waiting period, and don't use it as such. So be asking God to provide favor in the eyes of God and man. I quickly just want to cover some items, or list them, as you will, that we have been instructed in the past that we should not be asking for. Some of these are like asking God to make your decisions for you. You should rather ask God to guide your decision-making ability and bless the decisions you have made. And Mr. Wineland covered that one extensively in one sermon series, How God Speaks in 2006. Excessive blessings to spend on your own lust, covered here today. Don't ask for them. You don't need excessive blessings to spend on your own lust. You definitely want excessive blessings from God. Do not ask for trials to be removed, but ask that we rejoice in them and quickly learn the lesson we need to learn or what defect in our personality it is pointing to. This was covered by Mr. Matthews in How to Pray in 2007. Another one, asking to be ordained. Don't ask to be ordained, but rather ask God to prepare your mind that in the day he should require service of you, that you be ready to fill that spot. If it comes, it comes. And that was covered by Mr. Wineland in 2008. This list could go on and on and on, and in time more will be given and covered, but I hope that it gives you some pointers and food for thought when judging what and how to petition God. And you can modify this small list and add to it to grow your own personal lists of things to ask God for. In closing, brethren, turn over to Romans chapter 8, verses 26. Brethren, God knows what we need and what is good for our spiritual growth. He knows what is in our hearts and minds, even when we don't. We don't know our minds. It's amazing how much human nature can hide from us, how much pride and so forth that human nature will hide from our own selves. Romans 8, 26. In the same way, the Spirit also helps our weaknesses. For we do not know how to pray as we ought. Mr. Matthews pointed out a few years back that we have to be taught how to pray, that the natural carnal mind does not know how to begin a relationship with God. But the Spirit himself makes intercession for us with groanings which can't be uttered. In verse 27, he who searches the heart knows what is on the Spirit's minds, because he makes intercession for the saints according to God. God wants us to know who he is and in relation who we are, what we need, and where it all comes from. It all comes from a loving, kind, merciful, rich God. He owns all things and wants to give all these things to us. Malachi talks about our barns not being able to hold all the blessings that he wishes to give us, but only after he knows that they won't cause more harm than good. And I will close with this one last scripture, I will just read it to you in Proverbs. Proverbs 30 and verse 8. Actually, Proverbs 30 verse 8 and 9. Okay, two scriptures. Remove far from me falsehood and lies. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is needful for me. Lest I be full, deny you, and say, who is Yahweh? Or lest I be poor and steal, and so dishonor the name of my God. Brethren, we need to ask God.
Welcome, family, to another weekly Sabbath. As we go forward in God's church in these end times, we have to be careful on how we let events of this evil world affect us spiritually. We must have the courage to allow God into our lives and all we do. So the title of today's split sermon is Godly Courage. So, brethren, how do we allow godly courage into our lives? First, we need not to be discouraged. We can let trials we must fight drag us down, health, finances, problems at work. We have to be careful not to be discouraging to ourselves. You know, the 27th came around, the 19th came around. Well, how'd that affect us? And we've got to be careful not to be discouraging to others. Those people that were around, especially our spouse, our children, people in the church. So let's look at the definition of discouragement. The act of making something less likely to happen or making people less likely to do something. We need to fight against the negative thoughts that come into our minds. Discouragement or becoming discouraged generally leads to sin, as it is the opposite of acting in faith. Let's turn to Numbers 13, and we're going to read verses 17 through 33, and we're going to see how 10 negative people affected a whole nation for 40 years. So starting in Numbers 13 and verse 17, then Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, go up this way into the south and go up into the mountains and see what the land is like, whether the people who dwell there are strong or weak, few or many, whether the land they dwell in is a good or bad, whether the cities they inhabit are like camps and strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor, whether there are forests there or not. Be of good courage. There again, Moses is sending them off. Dangerous so-called mission, you might say, that they're going on, but they're going into a land of their enemies. And he told them to be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land. Now, the time was the season for the first ripe grapes. So they went up and spied out the land in the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob near the entrance of Hamath. I'm probably slaughtering those, but. And they went up through the south and came to Hebron. I'm not even going to attempt the rest of those. The descendants of Anak were there. Now, Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. And they came to the valley, and they cut down a branch with one of the clusters of grapes and carried between them on a pole. Now, I can remember the Bible stories as a kid, Basil Wolverton drawing a picture of these two men with this pole and this huge cluster of grapes between them. So, pretty amazing, just a side thought there, remembering that as a child. The place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the men of Israel cut down there. And they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. There again, you know, God's a test number of 40 days or 40 years, but the number 40. And they departed and came to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran. They brought back word to them and all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told them and said, we went up to the land you sent us and truly flows with milk and honey. And that this is the fruit. So, you know, there again, they saw what was good there, but let's just read on and just see how, you know, their negative thoughts and lack of trust in God. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong and the cities are fortified and large. Moreover, here's where the discouragement starts coming in. We saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, the Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses. Okay, here's where somebody with some courage is injecting. Let us go up at once and take possession, for we will all be able to overcome it. You know, there again, he had the courage to let God into his life. He'd come out of Egypt, gone through the Red Sea, and seen what God had done. And he took courage in that. But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." Well, they were relying on their own strength, not God's. And their own lack of courage instead of having godly courage in their lives. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies and the land that devours its inhabitants," all negative thoughts, "and all the people who we saw are in it, men of great stature. There we saw giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." All right, let's drop down to Numbers 14, and we're going to read verse 20 through 24 and then verse 34. And we're going to see what they got for being discouraged, for not trusting in God and going up with godly courage and taking the land that God said he was going to give to them. Okay, starting in verse 20. "Then the Lord said, 'I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. Because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness have put me to the test now in these 10 times and have not heeded my voice.'" In other words, everything God did for them and these people, these 10 negative spies that were leaders of each one of their tribes, they just didn't put their trust and courage in God and allow him to work in their lives and to take them up there and overcome the land. So let's read on verse 23. "They certainly shall not see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit," he had God's spirit working in him and giving him the courage to know that they could go up and take it, "and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it." So you can see there, just by his actions, his whole family was blessed because of it. "According to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days, and for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years you shall know my rejection." So they had to wander for 40 years out in the wilderness when they could have just gone right up and taken the land if they'd had the courage and trusted in God and had the godly courage to do it. All right, let's move on. This sermon is about godly courage, but we wanted to look at just how negative discouragement can be and how it can be on ourselves and other people. So let's look at the definition of encouragement. The act of making something more appealing or more likely to happen. The act that makes someone more likely to do something. So let's look at Ecclesiastes 4. And we're going to read verse 7 through 12. And now just see how this applies to our life, being encouraged to each other and staying loyal to each other, loyal to the people in the church. So starting in verse 7. "Then I returned and I saw vanity under the sun. There was one alone without companion." You know, brother, we got to be careful not to get off by ourselves and get discouraged and bring ourselves down, bring other people down. "He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors, nor his eyes satisfied with riches. But he never asked, 'For whom do I toll and deprive myself of good?' This also is vanity and a grave misfortune." But here's where being encouragement, verse 9, "Two are better than one, to be there to lift each other up, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, if one starts getting weak, getting discouraged, one will lift him up his companion." In other words, encourage to stick together as a family. "But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up." You know, and if we stay close to God and Jesus Christ, we've always got someone there to lift us up. So we don't want to get off by ourselves and have self-pity, and we just have to stay encouraged and stay close to God. "And again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone?" In other words, we need to keep each other spiritually hot, keep encouraging each other to stay close to those 57 truths and get together when we can. "The one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken." And you know, you think of that threefold cord. If we're repenting and staying close to God and Jesus Christ and they're living in us, each one of us is a threefold cord. We are the only weak part of that cord when we sin. We can only have godly courage if God is in us. All right, finally, let's look at the definition of courage. The ability to do something that you know is difficult or dangerous. So what we're going to do is look at some examples in the Bible of God's people that had godly courage. And most of these instances and stories are, it was a life and death situation. They grew up under a whole different society than we do. I mean, a lot of these governments back then, they could take your life without trial, or it was a dangerous place to live at times. But anyway, let's go to Deuteronomy 1, and we're going to read verse 30 through 38, and this is talking about Joshua and Caleb and their godly courage. Starting in verse 30. And the Lord your God who goes before you, he will fight for you. Well, there it says it right there. That God's going to do the fighting for us. We have to go, but we have to show the courage to do it, but we also have the courage to trust in God and know that he's going to work things out in our life. Okay, going on. According to all he did in Egypt before your eyes. There again, he gave him a lot of examples of how he would take care of him. What has God done for us in our lives as we fight Egypt's sin? You know, he's there to strengthen us and through the Holy Spirit and the truths he's given us. And going on in verse 31. And in the wilderness where you saw how the Lord your God carried you as a man carries his son in all the way that you went until you came to this place. And there again, through the plagues of Egypt, through the Red Sea, you know, they went to at Mount Horeb and the things that happened there. And here they are at the Jordan River, you know, and they could have gone across then, but because of 10 negative people, they had to wait 40 years. Yet for all that you did not believe the Lord your God, who went the way before you and stretched out a place for you to pitch your tents and showed you the way to go in the fire by night and the cloud by day. And the Lord heard the sound of your words and was angry and took an oath saying, surely not one of these men of this evil generation shall see that good land of which I swore to give to your fathers, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and he shall see it, and to him and his children I am giving the land in which that he walked, because he wholly followed the Lord. And the Lord was also angry with me for your sake, saying, even you shall not go in there. And speaking of Moses. And then Joshua, the son of Nun, who stands before you, he shall go in there. Encourage him, for he shall cause Israel to inherit it. In other words, that's who God was going to work through 40 years from then. You know, so both Caleb and Joshua had godly courage. All right, let's move on to another example still at the time of Joshua and when the spies went up. This is when they're going across. And let's go to the story of Rahab. You know, a lot of times we can just read through these verses, and there's just a few verses here concerning her. But a lot of time passed just through these verses and what was going on in her mind. There again, she was a harlot in the land, probably not well thought of and mistreated, but she had the courage to hide these two spies and pretty well put her life on the line for it. So let's start in Joshua 2 and verse 1. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, sent out two men to the acacia grove to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came to the house of the harlot named Rahab and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country. Well, there again, there's two spies, and I'm sure her fate would have been the same as theirs had they been caught. And the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, bring out the men that you have come to you and have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land and the country. Then the woman took the two men and hid them. So she said, yes, these men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it happened that as the gate began to shut, you know, they shut the city up at night, especially knowing that a nation of Israel was just across the river from them. And when it was dark, the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them. So she kind of sent them on a wild goose chase, and we'll just see how it worked out that she actually saved these men's life by putting her life on the line. But she brought them up to the roof and hid them in the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order to order on the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan and to the fjords. And as soon as those who pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to them, I know the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. In other words, these people, it was well known what happened at the Red Sea and what happened to Egypt. So, like I say, these people were faint-hearted and concerned about what their future held. We have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, whom you utterly destroyed. It took godly courage for her to hide these men. If she'd been found out, the outcome would have not gone well for her. All right, let's go to another example. We're going to look at take a small portion out of Esther's story. I think if you go back to January of 2009, I think there's a three-part series on Esther and what she did. Goes into it more detail, but we're just going to touch on it here. So let's go to Esther 4 and verse 10. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one law, to put them all to death, except the one that the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called into the king for 30 days. So there again, Mordecai's asking her to go to the king. Haman's causing problems for Israel. So she's telling Mordecai that, hey, if I go in there without being asked, I'm dead. So they told Mordecai Esther's words, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do you think that in your heart that you will escape the king's palace any more than all the other Jews? In other words, Haman was out to kill the Jews, and she was a Jew, and she wasn't going to escape. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place. In other words, we yield ourselves to God and allow God to come into our lives and give us the courage. He's called us out, especially those of us that came out of the apostasy. And we've got to trust in God and go forward because, he can work with other people, but he's chose to work with us. So we have to have the godly courage to go through these evil end times and just wait on God. And that takes courage, is just to wait, hopefully and prayerfully that we're in this last lap, and hopefully Christ will return this next Pentecost. But if not, God's going to give us the courage to go to the next Pentecost, and we live Pentecost to Pentecost. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come into the kingdom for such a time as this? In other words, that's why Esther was called. It was just for that. Why are we being called? Well, to do this work for God and to stay loyal, again, be encouraging to each other and those that, look for an answer from us when asked. And there again, we just answer the question and we don't go any further than that. But there again, God's working through each and every one of us in different ways. Then Esther told him to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go into the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. And there again, she knew that what she was about to do for Israel, for the Jews, she could lose her life, right then and there. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. So, a lot of times we just look at, well, men are the ones with courage. Well, it's pretty evident that, and I'm not hitting on all the women in the Bible that showed courage and strength. But that's just it. It just doesn't matter our stature when godly courage is in us. It doesn't know gender. So anyway, Esther had the godly courage to go into the king on a chance of being killed. All right, moving on to our next example. We're going to go to 1 Samuel 17 and read verse 33 through 40. Mr. Matthews covered this whole chapter in his series on signs of pride and really went into David, but I just wanted to hit on this one part of that chapter where David just knew that God would give him the courage to do what he did. And a comment was made in that series that godly confidence is humility. And this is also true with courage, that godly courage is humility, because we have the humility to know that God is going to give us the strength to do something. And David knew God would give him courage. So let's start in verse 33 and just go over this story. We've all heard it so many times, but it just shows how a young shepherd boy, we don't know his age, but he must have been in his teens just by the description of him. And he'd been out taking care of the sheep in his youth, and there were times that he had to go up against wild animals and whatnot, but God gave him the courage, so he knew that God would be there. So let's start in verse 33. And Saul said to David, "You're not able to go up against the Philistines to fight with them, for you are a youth and a man, and he a man of war from his youth." You know, so Saul's looking at David and just judging him by his outward appearance as a young man and not on his heart and what he believed in God. But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it." I can't imagine doing that with going out and taking on an African lion or a bear, "and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it rose against me, I caught it by the beard and struck and killed it." God was building courage in him for what was ahead. "Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defiled the armies of the living God." In other words, David knew that God was there, and the Israelites were God's people, and God was for them, and this Philistine was profaning God, and David had the godly courage to go out there knowing God would go with him. Verse 37. "Moreover, David said, 'The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine.' And Saul said to David, 'Go, and the Lord will be with you.' So Saul clothed David with his armor and put a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed him with a coat of mail." You know, there again, as Mr. Matthews went over all this, it's just unfamiliar and untested armor and weapons that David knew nothing about. He'd not used them before. That isn't what he used to slay the lion and the bear. And David fastened his sword and his armor and tried to walk, and he had to test them. And David said to Saul, "I cannot walk with these, for I have not tested them." So David took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, something that he was familiar with, and he chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, something he knew that he knew what to pick out and what he could use in his sling and be accurate with, you know, something he tested, and put them in his shepherd's bag and in a pouch which he had, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. You know, just thinking about this, and he drew near to the Philistine. He's closing the distance because he knew what his accuracy was with his sling. You know, it was something that he tested in the field. So he was going by what, with the courage of God working in him, and he was closing the distance so that he could be effective. What spiritual weapons do we have? Have we proven in battle? What is our spiritual sling? What spiritual stones do we throw at our spiritual Goliaths? Is not the Holy Spirit and the power in which we sling the stones of the 57 truths at the problems that come along in our lives? I mean, that's what we've tested in battle, and we come on trials. We need to go back to what's been tested and not rely on ourselves, but to rely on God and have the godly courage to go forward on these spiritual Goliaths in our lives, and God's going to put them in our hands, and we're going to overcome them and defeat them, but it's going to take godly courage to do it. All right, let's move on to a next example. Back in 2007-2008, we really went through the story of Gideon and then the 300. But let's just go to Judges 6, and we're going to read from verse 12 to 17. And anyway, let's get into it, starting verse 12. "And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, 'The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor.'" Encouragement. He was encouraged right off. Right at the start there from the angel of the Lord, that mighty man of valor, and he was given encouragement right to begin with, but it took time for God to build that courage in Gideon. "And Gideon said to him, 'Oh my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And why are all his miracles which our father told us about, saying, Did not the Lord bring you up out of Egypt? But how the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hand of the Midianites. So anyway, there again, this angel has appeared to Gideon and told him that, encouraged him right off the start there. But it took some time for God to show Gideon that he was with them. And, you know, we know the story of the fleece with a dew on and the dew off and the bread rolling down the hill. But it took time for God to build that courage in Gideon so that he could do what God was going to do through him. And then verse 14, then the Lord turned to him and said, go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you? So he said to him, oh my Lord, how can I save Israel? And so he still was lacking that godly courage, but God was going to give it to him, and we know the story. Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and he's discouraging himself. He's talking himself. God's trying to build him up, and he's tearing himself down. And I am the least in my father's house. And the Lord has said to him, surely I will be with you, more encouragement, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man, more encouragement. And then he said to him, if now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you that talk to me. Through all the signs that God used to show Gideon, he was with him. Godly courage was instilled in Gideon. So there again, it's just, and God does it with us too. And we're going to get into that here just a little bit later. Is that, you know, things that have happened in our life, whether going through the apostasy, like I said, later on, we're going to get into some of the truths of the 57 truths that have built courage in us. All right, brother, now we're going to look at godly courage in our time. Go back to Mr. Armstrong, and if any of you haven't read his autobiography, I strongly recommend that you do, because it just goes through his life and just shows us how God really built courage in him. I mean, from the time he was, you know, a young boy and looking for answers to things, and that led him on to a very successful life in the early part of his life and later in his life. But he had to go through some things, and God built courage in him so that he could do the end time Philadelphia work, and how strongly that message got out. But go through and read that, but the part where his wife challenged him to prove the Sabbath, whether it was the seventh day Sabbath or Sunday, and he had the courage to go through and prove that. And when God showed him that it was a seventh day Sabbath, he had the courage to go forward with it and to change his life. So if you get a chance, you can find the autobiographies on, you know, the internet, on Barnes and Noble, or I think that's where I found mine, was something like that. But anyway, I encourage you to read those, because it's quite a story, and a lot of us lived part of that life with Mr. Armstrong and actually saw firsthand what courage he had to do things. I mean, to go talk to kings and queens and the people of parliaments and the diet in Japan. I mean, he got open doors and he walked through them. And so, you know, there again, the courage in our end time, it's here. God's still working with it, building it in his people. And then look at the two witnesses, God's two prophets at this time. Just not only what they've gone through since the apostasy and how God built courage in them and courage to, you know, no, I'm not here for a paycheck. I'm here to obey God and walk away from that and the beginning of starting this end time work. And, you know, look at where we're at right now. God's prophets sitting falsely accused in prison. And then his wife, the prophet of God, is, you know, out there spearheading this church and carrying it on and doing the administration and being able to get up in front of congregations as she visits and update all of us and keep us updated on Ron and whatnot. And, you know, just the courage that's there with both of them. And, you know, and we need to pray for not only God's two witnesses to give them godly courage, but for each and every one of us. How has God prepared us with godly courage for what is ahead? And he has, and we might not realize it, but trials we go through and overcome, well, we learn that, you know, to trust in God and have that godly courage. So let's look at some of the 57 truths and see how God, and there's just, we're not going to go through all of them, but just a few here just to hit on and see how God has built courage in each and every one of us. You know, let's go to truth number four, which is the first one of Philadelphia, and it's the government of God. You know, it's just the changes in God's government here just in the past 2 years, where women are being ordained and being a very big part in working and assisting in this work. We just recently had a three-part post on ordinations in the church and how those that government's there to help us to grow, to overcome, to really see God's government and not let it get discouraging to us when we, you know, inject our own understanding, but to rely on God when He does something in His government to be behind it and support it and help each and every one of those individuals do their jobs and come closer to God, and so that church can go forward in unity and harmony. But there again, it's just to have the courage to do that, and not only those that are ordained, but then the ones that aren't ordained, to have the courage to support those that are. Okay, let's look at Truth 23, and that's the second one in Laodicea. The man of sin has been revealed to be Joseph Koch Sr., who initiated the end time apostasy. You know, I know somebody that's left recently that was what they, when they read the book 2008, they said that's what proved to them that this was God's church and whatnot. But it's still true. I mean, he gave that sermon in December of 94 and 40 Sabbaths to the hour. And we have two people that were in that audience that can witness to that. And you can pull up his death certificate. Anyway, my point being is that did happen. And that individual that I was speaking of, you know, okay, if that, it's still true. And that's what they considered to be the thing that proved that this was God's church. But they're no longer with us. So we have to have the courage that, yes, this did happen. And those numbers are numbers that God uses, and we have to have the faith and the courage to believe that. You know, and God showed that to us. You know, there again, building that courage so that we could go past the 27th and the 19th, and we can now live Pentecost to Pentecost, because those things happen, and we witness them, and God continues building courage one layer on another in ours, so that when it comes down to what's ahead of us, and we don't know what's ahead of us totally. We know Christ is going to return soon. We know this world is in sad shape. But there again, it's just another truth. And all these truths, we really need to go over them often. Even if you just read the bold print, it doesn't take long to go through them. And just have to ask yourself, each one of them, do I believe that? Well, if you believed it today, you should be believing it tomorrow if we're staying close to God. So anyway, let's move on to Truth 42, which is 21. And, alright, Truth 42. God the Father is Yahweh Elohim, and He alone is eternally existent. You know, and God showed us, He finally brought us all the way out of the Trinity back in 2005, the Feast of Tabernacles. Listen to those sermons, and it's good to go back over them. But, you know, He there again, just showing us that this is God's church, set us apart from all the churches in the apostasy. This was one of the big ones that, you know, God isn't a Trinity. He alone has existed. And those scriptures, if you go back to those sermons that just jump out at you now, but until it was God's time to show us that that was the truth and whatnot, we just had to wait for it. And it's just like everything else as we go on through this life, that we have to wait on God and have the godly courage to do it. All right, let's look at truth, the 50th truth, and that's probably one of the longest that goes into more detail there. But, you know, for so many years, we thought Christ was going to return on trumpets, and there again, people go back and mock and say, oh, you guys changed it. Well, no, it was the present truth, and when we were given the present truth that Christ wasn't returning on a day of trumpets, but on a Pentecost, then we changed, and He showed us that that 1,335 days from trumpets of 2008 to Pentecost of 2012, that doesn't occur for 100 years before 2008 and 100 years after, you know. And people go, well, it might occur, but yeah, not at these end times. And so God showed us that was that 3.5 years of the witness where, you know, and nobody listened. But those numbers just don't happen again. You know, it's just like the 40 Sabbaths that Mr. Koch that we just covered. You know, things like these, they just don't happen. It's just God plans this out perfectly. And there again, building more courage in us so that we can continue to go forward and do this work that God set before us, and that we can have that godly courage. All right, the last truth we're going to look at is the 53rd truth, the ordination of women in the church, and that ties into number 4, God's government. And, you know, as it's been stated through sermons and posts and whatnot, there's been people that have had issues with that, and it's just caused them to become discouraged instead of being encouraged by it, that, you know, God's lifting that curse off the women of not only this church, but eventually the world as a whole. And there again, when it comes down to godly courage or godly faith, it knows no gender. It's how close each and every one of us are to God, and it doesn't matter whether we're male or female, but God's going to work through us if we allow Him to do so. All right, we just need to remember Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Wineland. A lot of people have mentioned this, that a third of the Bible is prophecy, and 90% of that is about this end time. What will it be written about in this end time? Are there going to be stories of godly courage about Philadelphia era of the church, and now the Laodiceans gone by, and now this remnant that is going forward and waiting for the return of Jesus Christ? But as we do wait for the return of Jesus Christ, we continue to have the courage to work on our problems in our lives, to have the courage to encourage people, to help them to stay strong and stay steadfast. So, you know, I think that things will be written about this time, I'm pretty sure. If 90% of prophecies about this time, the answers that so many people have had questions to, I think, will be there. And we as this little church at this end time are using godly courage to wait for the return of Jesus Christ. And that's just what we have to do, is just continue to go to God and just help Him when we feel like we're getting weak. I mean, so many examples that, you know, where God's asked somebody to do something and you know, you go back to Gideon and it just took some time for God to build that courage. But as we go forward and we go through this life, we do build that godly courage. All right, now we're going to look at the courage that Christ had. And there's an 8-part series entitled This World's Passover, which really goes into depth of this. And it's basically about it's just about the last 2 weeks of His life. And we're going to read 2 excerpts from Matthew and Luke about His last night and just see what the ultimate in godly courage is. So let's go to Matthew 26 and verse 36, and we're going to read through verse 44. And this is when it was after the Passover supper, when dinner, when they were out in the garden and praying. And then Jesus came to the place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, "Sit here while I go pray over there." And He took with Him the 2 sons of Zebedee, and He began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. I mean, He knew what was ahead of Him in a very short period of time. And then He said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful." I mean, there again, He's a human being with human emotions. He had the mind of God, but He was still human, and He knew what was ahead of Him. And anyway, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with Me." And He went a little further and fell on His face and prayed, saying, "Oh, My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from Me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as You will." There again, it was He had the courage to, and the godly courage, full of godly courage, to go forward and do what His Father wanted Him to do. And thankfully, He had the courage to do that, or our lives wouldn't be worth much. And, you know, there again, just by Him doing that, we were allowed to have that Holy Spirit come into us, because He was able to be God's Passover for us and cover the sins in our lives so that God can live in us and we can be that 3-strong cord. Okay, verse 40. "Then He came to the disciples and found them asleep and said to Peter, 'What? Could you not watch with Me 1 hour? Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak.'" And, you know, we need to really remember that our flesh is weak, and the only thing that makes us strong is God's Spirit living in us, and that's what gives us the courage again to, you know, live this way of life and just to go forward to the return of Jesus Christ. And verse 42, "Again the second time He went away and prayed, saying, 'Oh, My Father, if this cup cannot pass from Me unless I drink it, Your will be done.'" And there again, He had the godly courage. He was very sorrowful and fearful, and as we'll read in the next excerpt, to the point of sweating blood. And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away again and prayed the third time, saying the same words. All right, let's go to Luke 22, and we're going to read verse 39 through 46. This is just a Luke's version of what happened that night. It goes in a little bit more to what happened, but Luke 22, 39 through 46. Come out, and he went to the Mount of Olives, as he was accustomed, and his disciples also followed him. When he came to the place, he said to them, pray that you may not enter into temptation. And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and prayed, saying, Father, if it is your will, take this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. Then the angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great droplets of blood falling down to the ground. I mean, can't imagine the agony that he was in and just knowing what was ahead of him in just a very short period of time. And when he rose from prayer, he came to the disciples and he found them sleeping from sorrow. And he said to them, why do you sleep? Rise and pray, lest you enter into temptation. So Christ set the perfect example for godly courage. All right, for the next verse, let's go to Hebrews 12. And we're going to read verse 1 through 3. Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, and we can look back to the Bible, I mean, even Hebrews 11, it just goes through some of those witnesses, that great cloud that surrounds us, we can't help but see them. You know, if you're in a cloud, you can't help but see the cloud, and we're surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses. Let us lay aside every weight, in other words, everything that just discourages us, that brings us down and keeps us from focusing on the return of Jesus Christ, on this way of life and going on, and the sin which so easily ensnares us. You know, we got to ask God to give us the courage to overcome those sins and be on the lookout for the ones that we know we're the weakest at, and ask God to show us, you know, the ones that we're weakest at. And let us run with the endurance the race that is set before us. There again, we press forward Pentecost to Pentecost, looking to Jesus Christ, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the stake, despising the shame, and sat down at the right hand on the throne of God. You know, that's what's ahead of us is being an Elohim. You know, and we have got to have the courage and ask God for the godly courage to just go forward and to wait on him. For consider him who endured such hostility for sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. Have the godly courage to allow God into all aspects of our lives. Cast our cares on God, and he will give us the godly courage to go forward to the return of his Son, our King. All right, in closing, let's go to Joshua 1, and we're going to read verse 5 through 9. Joshua 1 and 5 through 9, and we're right back to where we started. No man shall be able to stand before you in all the days of your life. This is encouragement coming from God. And as I was with Moses, I will be with you, and I will not leave you nor forsake you. And that same promise is to us too, as long as we stay close to God. Be strong and of good courage. For this people you shall divide as an inheritance in the land that I swore to your fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe and do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn it to the right hand nor to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. In other words, just stay loyal to the law. Do it to the letter of the law and living this way of God's life. So verse 8, the book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, and you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your ways prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? And this is a command just like any other command from God. Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go.